Schaefer Podcast Spectacular.
Get a little level on the talking there. Oh yeah, that looks good.
Check, check. Sibilance. Mic check. Word to your moms.
That's a mess.
When I'm podcasting, I'm talking fasting. Conversations lasting. We're getting drastic.
Damn.
The sun has set on West Texas, East Texas, all over Texas right now. All of Texas is in darkness. It's a very normal temperature. Well, sorry, not a normal temperature. It's warm for December, but that's the way it sometimes goes. We are so excited to be here for episode 197 of One Magical Hour, a Mathman Schaefer Podcast Spectacular. We're calling this the 200th episode. We are on the porch of the cabin on my dad and my stepmom's land in San Saba County, Texas. It is. We've had some beers, I'll be honest with you. Some of us, i.e. myself, might have had more than others, but no one's counting because we're just having fun out here in the country with Manish and Dr. Hall and, you know him, you love him, the pride of Tarzana, California, the God's gift to children's folk rock, Matthew Rampey.
Born in the valley down in Texas Sea, reddest state in the land of the free, raised in the woods so he knew every tree, killed himself a bear when he was only three. Dr. Grant Hall, king of the wild frontier. Now, listen, Schaefer, I got to blow the cover here because I didn't know you were going to do this, but we are not actually on the porch out in mountain pasture. We were recently at Schaefer's dad's place, and we were sitting on the porch, and we had some beers, and Manish was there, but we are back in the ivy-covered castle. We failed to record kind of an intro to a very special episode. Episode 197, the 200th episode extravaganza.
And a very special episode.
Basically, what we have for you for this episode is that Dick Cavett style, I interviewed Schaefer's dad when we were at his place. And it was riveting, and we're going to present that to you momentarily.
Delight.
But, you know, we do, in this intro, we do have the benefit of, we know how the interview went, and so, let me ask you, did you learn anything when we were talking to your dad?
There were, honestly, I don't remember what they were now, but there were some surprises.
Okay. Well, you're going to listen again, right? You
can. One that I've actually thought about several times since then is his theory that whistle was sitting on the lips of the dead Mayan prince.
Oh,
so that maybe it would, if he started breathing and maybe came alive or something, it would blow a whistle and maybe let people know that, hey, I'm still alive in here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's so funny that I said that. None of that is exaggeration or...
It feels a little like you should have said spoiler alert. But,
no.
Well, that was... I mean, it was... obviously, I learned a lot. I didn't really know anything about your dad's career, but I had been I had been curious about it, and you know, the last 50 times I've run into your dad, he's asked me to call him by his first name, and I finally did. I think he appreciates that.
I'm so proud of you.
I was talking to my wife about that, and she was like, "You're not going to do it, right?" And I was like, "Well, the respectful thing here is to call the person what they asked to be called." Which is nothing like how I ask people to call me Matthew, and it's like such a bother, you know. But
yeah.
Anyway, I guess we don't have anything else we need to preface that with. It really kind of, I think that all sort of speaks for itself. The most important thing is that, and the reason that we couldn't continue with this ruse that we were actually there and about to do the interview is that the audio is a little different. It was a bit windy that day. We were sort of nestled up on the porch, but I've had to kind of wean us with the audio, and I think it sounds okay. So anyway.
Great. Thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having
quite the wind blowing.
It was insane.
Such that like at the end of the day, I felt kind of wind exhausted.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a blustery day for sure.
Because there are other things that could have been contributing to that
exhaustion. Wow, yeah, a lot. I mean, it was a big day, you know.
What a fun day. Yeah, fun day. Great conversation. We're so excited to bring you this episode. And thanks to my dad, Grant, a.k.a. Dr. Hall, for being a really good sport and hanging out and talking with us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Grant. And, the poor, the choices.
The sweeter the wine.
Oh. Huh. What was happening there? Okay. We are recording now, but just go about your business. It's just a documentary.
You shouldn't have said that. You should have just said that. It's like, if you said nothing, it's not recording.
No. It's just like a documentary where the documentarian doesn't have any biases and, you know, it's completely subjective. And I'm completely objective. And it was recording through my phone. Uh-huh. It was connected to the phone and I disconnected it, and now I can see the waveform real good, and that was weird. That's never happened before.
Since we had an open fire here, it was probably the last time you guys were here.
No. Oh, the last time they were there?
You mean in 2020?
Maybe. See, we've gotten so civilized after we moved up into the house.
I see. And how long did y'all live down here?
Patsy was here 3 years, and I was here about 2.5.
Wait, she lived here before you moved
here?
Yeah,
we were living in Junction, and I was still working for Texas Tech. And she got word that they were looking for an English teacher here at Richland Springs. So
she was living in here?
Well, we went into panic mode, and I've been doing the carpentry, you know.
Oh, yeah, a little of the expansion build.
And anyway, when that job came open, we talked it over and decided that she'd go ahead and take it, and I'd stay on there at Texas Tech Junction for another 6 months or something like that. So she came down here.
Would you move your chair closer over here? Thanks.
Because
now it's an interview. And if you could project at the laptop as well. Thank you, sir.
I located three guys from Brady that were recommended to do small carpentry jobs, and they finished out the back there and got the plumbing going and everything. So
Well, I've been really soft about judging the carpentry here because I thought you did it. But now that those jabronis now that I know there was those jabrons from Brady, I'm going to take a real hard look at it.
That's what it's kind of like going down the rabbit hole. If you notice the sign by the shower in there, cold is hot and hot is cold.
Oh, is that right?
Because Jose,
a lot of showers might have could have used a sign like that.
Jose and company got the.
It's funny how often that's
got
a problem.
The two hoses reversed.
Wait, is that the one you want?
Yeah,
that's
good.
So anyway, we moved. I was really proud of her for living over here by herself, you know, but she was from out here in the country, so she wasn't worried about being
And this is her family's property?
Her dad's property.
Now, how long's he had it?
I wish she was here. Probably from sometime in the 60s.
Okay. And where did they live?
In Richland Springs.
Oh, she's from Richland Springs.
Yeah.
It's a cute little town. And the way that you're sort of on a little bluff and you sort of come down off the bluff into Richland Springs, that's really nice.
And it used to be a much more vigorous community. There were...
I see that there had been activity in the past.
Two or three grocery stores. There were cafes. There was a pool hall.
And then Walmart came to Texas and ruined it all.
I probably had something to do with it, but... It probably would have gone downhill even without things like that happening.
I love that Main Street. I mean, it looks like somebody could step out there and have a shootout.
Yeah. Well, I can't believe nobody's filmed anything there. It looks like a good
it's picturesque.
It looks like a good filming area.
It's one of many small towns like that. We're just a little farther out, so it hadn't started getting gentrified like
it's coming, don't you worry,
Fredericksburg or Mason or whatever. And
you'll get your yoga studios sooner or later.
It's very gratifying to see there's some younger people in town that have started an urban renewal process. Starting to try to clean up, and
we're talking about Richland Springs, Texas, just to be clear on this recording.
Richland Springs.
You know, I kind of had it in the back of my mind that we might get a chance to just sit down and do just a little interview. So I did have some questions for you. Okay. Are you ready?
Yep.
You are a geologist. Is that right?
Archaeologist.
Oh, you're an archaeologist. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when did that interest start in your life?
It actually started when I was pretty young. I'd say probably 10 years old. We lived there in South Texas, in the town of Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, Texas, in South Texas, okay.
And my dad, for most of his life, had been traveling into Mexico to various places. When he was young, it was Saltillo.
To do what was his business?
Well, his... when he was young, my grandmother would take him and his two brothers down to Saltillo. They stayed at a guest ranch down there during the summer just to escape the heat. My grandfather had a legal practice there in Edinburgh, and he would come down on the weekends. And that's where my dad and his brothers learned to speak Spanish.
Okay.
But anyway, he was comfortable going to Mexico, and by the time... I was old enough, he was taking us down into northern Mexico, not too far south of the border, but we would collect arrowheads. And that was my early stimulation, was collecting the arrowheads. A lot of people do that now. Some people, you know, go beyond the material objects and get interested in who the people were. And that's kind of the path that serious archaeologists go on. If you decide to make a career of it, you want to learn as much as you can about who the people were.
And why were y'all traveling into Mexico?
Just weekend trips.
Just weekend trips. I away. See. Yeah. It wasn't his business.
No, it was not his business.
Oh, I see. And, okay. Well, what was his business?
He's also an attorney.
An attorney.
Yeah, okay. My grandfather and dad and two uncles, actually.
Oh, so did you buck the family trend?
I did.
By becoming a researcher?
My sister Kim and my nephew Trevor and my son Richard, y'all call him Dick, are all attorneys too, but I didn't go that route.
I'm surrounded by attorneys too. My sister's an attorney. Amy's brother is an attorney. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'm so glad that you went the archaeology way. It's so much more interesting. Sorry to the attorneys in the crowd.
I was very lucky in the timing. When I was in high school, I had continued this interest and got more and more serious. I was planning to go to the University of Texas. My dad wrote a letter to the anthropology department up there and said, my son's interested in a career in archaeology. What kind of advice can you give us? I wish I still had the letter. We got this letter back, and they said, Dear Mr. Hall, your son really has virtually no chance of a career in archaeology. You should advise him to go into some other field of study.
Oh. So,
he showed it to me, and I said, well, okay. So I went up there.
Did he have any reasoning?
It probably, if that letter was written in 1968, it was probably pretty reasonable advice.
Just because archaeologists weren't getting paid anything.
There were not many jobs.
I see.
But what happened, the year I graduated from high school, 1969, they passed the Environmental Protection Act. And one very small part of it had to do with archaeological and historical resources.
So, like, what you mean is, like, not fracking at burial grounds.
Right.
Or at least excavating the burial ground before you frack there.
I always excavate my burial ground before I frack there.
Yeah. Or before you say build an aquifer.
Yeah,
right?
More formally, since these were federal laws, if there were any permits, licenses required, that might make a project eligible for an archaeological study. It might be something like a pipeline or a power line or reservoir construction. The Environmental Protection Act, some parts of it would require that these archaeological studies be done before they could. So
who was the president that got that EPA going?
It was 1970. It wasn't
was
really.
Was that Nixon?
It wasn't the president so much as,
it was a movement.
A movement.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like, I think of it as a wave out on the ocean. It was a wave that just started forming up and I caught the wave. And it opened up a lot of jobs for entry-level field.
So, like, 14-ish years later, when you saw Indiana Jones, did you realize that wave really had taken momentum? When the world had romanticized archaeology, did you see, like, oh, did you feel like people were like, oh, now everybody can see what I see. It's so exciting to look back into the past.
Movie for us pros to laugh at.
Oh, I see. I see. That's hilarious.
But there were drinking contests, I'm sure, just like at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost.
No. I mean, I wasn't actually like. It is exciting, right? But the mechanics of it are,
well,
tedious.
It's pretty mundane.
Yeah. Okay.
You
okay.
have to, real meticulous work. When you're out in the field, if you find something kind of fragile or complicated in the ground, you've got to expose it very carefully and then do drawings of it, photograph it. Remove it very carefully, document it in written form in field notes that you take.
And so where all have you been archaeological site wise in the world? I know, did you say something about Guatemala?
Yeah, primarily in Texas. And so I started out in 72. My first paid job was a survey out in Northeast Texas in these swampy areas where they were gonna put a pipeline through. And we did part of it on foot, a lot of alligators out there.
Is that like Caddo country?
It's Caddo, And even, well, closer to the coast, the Caddo didn't get over there. That was more people-oriented, eating shellfish and fishing and that kind of thing. But anyway, that's how I started out. And I was had worked maybe 2 years as kind of a apprentice or journeyman field technician, field archaeologist. Actually, in the summer of 74, I was up at Lubbock working on the Lubbock Lake site for Dr. Eileen Johnson. I was a crew chief at that point. I had enough, a little more experience than other people. So I was a crew chief for her for 3 months that summer.
The Lubbock Lake site, that's an exciting site.
Yes, it was very interesting. Yeah. And that experience of working for her on that project was one of the important formative periods in my career. Well, I got back from that, came back to Austin, and my mentor, Elton Pruitt, was working for the Texas Archaeological Research Lab, a research division of the University of Texas, and we were out at what was then called Balcones Research Center. It's now the J.J. Pickle Research Center
right.
in Northwest Austin.
Sure.
And the man in charge was Dr. David Dibble, who's he's deceased now, but he had a very interesting career too. He was heading up this research laboratory, and they had one of these projects where some archaeology was going to be required to get their federal permits. And this was a nuclear plant site that was planned down between Sealy and Rosenberg along the Brazos River.
Okay.
So we went out there. It looked like it was going to be pretty straightforward. And Elton and Dave thought that I would, you know, I had enough experience that I could run this little crew and we could get the work done. And so we got out there. And it turned out that at the exact place they were going to build the cores for the nuclear reactor, there was a prehistoric Native American burial ground.
So it seems like bad luck, right?
Yeah. A little bit. So,
was there anything political about your involvement? Like, there was, you're working for the government. Did they want you to go out there and not find anything so that things could happen?
It was pretty straightforward. I mean, it was pretty big shock to everybody to realize that was there. But they said, well, you know, we need to go ahead with this project, so go ahead and excavate it. And we ended up recovering plus or minus 230 human skeletons.
Whoa.
And they were stratified into four distinct layers. The earliest ones were about 4,000, 5,000 years old.
Wow.
And then there were successively younger layers of burials.
So there were people there for a long time.
Do you think you got buried on top of your dad?
It's possible that they were, you know,
some kind of.
There was a genetic.
This is the place. The ancestors.
So anyway, it turned out to be a real important site. And my boss told me later, if they had realized what was going to be found there, they would never have put me. But by the time it was all happening, you know, it was Houston Lighting and Power Company, and they were anxious to proceed with their construction, you know, so.
So you got the construction guy, he comes and he's like, all right, you find anything, chief? And you're like, maybe we found something.
It was, and they were pressuring us about the cost of it and saying at that time that every day that we delayed them was costing them $200,000 or something. So we
bluff.
We did that work, and the report that I wrote did not come out until 1981. I continued working on it after I started another job. But the fact that I had been the director on that project and we had recovered all those human remains was important for a later important development in my career. Well, I was also from South Texas, and I was real interested in the archaeology of that part of the state. About 1977, they were planning to build the Choke Canyon Reservoir on the Frio River,
okay,
down about 90 miles south of San Antonio. And I was trying to get my boss at TARL, the Texas Archaeological Research Lab, to bid on it, but he was too busy with other projects. And Dr. Tom Hester, who was a professor down at UT San Antonio, ended up getting the Choke Canyon project through his facility, which was called the Center for Archaeological Research, CAR. So anyway, I can't remember if I offered my services or he contacted me, but I ended up going to work for Tom Hester down at UT San Antonio in 1977 to do excavations on sites that would be inundated by the Choke Canyon Reservoir.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, we started on that. And that was Shay had been born at that point, was a couple of years old when we moved down to San Antonio.
That's when I left Boston.
That's right. I think it was in January of 78 that you and Shiloh moved down there. And so anyway, I was working on that project.
Did you find anything down there?
A lot of hunter-gatherer camps, basically.
Sure. It was, and so you like duck, and then the reservoir still got built.
It hadn't. The reservoir there's a big lake there now.
Yeah.
So, but an interesting side note, they never did build the nuclear plant where we
excavated. I was going to ask. I imagine. Oh, yeah. We
kind of went off the nuclear plant story. They never built it.
They never built it, and that's sad. But at the time, you know, they thought, we're going to start on it as soon as you archaeologists are through. But
was that research that you uncovered there? I mean, it was significant, right?
It was
important. It must have been an exciting time when you
It was. And
found this site.
Interesting also, since that power company had already condemned all that land, hundreds of acres down there, and part of a nuclear plant is you got to have some kind of reservoir of water. It could be ocean water, but there they were going to build a lake that they would fill from the Brazos River, and that would be the cooling lake for the power plant. Well, they kept the land. They didn't build the nuclear plant. And now, 50 years later, the Brazos River Authority is planning to go ahead and complete that reservoir. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty excited to see there's going to be more archaeology done there. And it's going to be real interesting for me to see what happens there now. But anyway, I'd gone to work for UT San Antonio, and one of the other professors there, that university was Dr. Richard E.W. Adams, and he already had a reputation as an expert on the Maya down in Central America. He had started his
say his name again. I'm sorry.
Richard E.W. Adams.
Okay. Did we talk about him recently?
I don't think so, but these are looming names from my childhood.
Okay, sorry.
And
I think we talked about them off mic. I think because this is all ringing a bell.
Well,
go ahead.
I was working there, and some of my other good friends and colleagues, Steve Black, Dan Potter, Fred Valdez, we were all working there, and Richard Adams got word that a Maya site in northwestern Guatemala was being heavily looted, and the looters had found some very interesting tombs that had paintings on the walls. They were subterranean tombs. And in the 60s, Adams had written an article simply documenting the presence of this museum. It was called Rio Azul. And when he was informed about the looting going on, he began trying to organize an expedition down there. It's pretty funny when you go down into the Maya world, you call it an expedition, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Instead of
right.
The more mundane names we had for projects here in Texas.
But well, anyway. I mean, it's also, that's an interest, very different impetus for the project than like a government program to see if the nuclear plant can be built here. This was like, these sites are getting looted, yeah, and we got to do something about it. This gets a little more into the realm of Indiana Jones.
Salvage and recovery.
You got to beat the Nazis
in Texas,
to it. You
know? It's called a dig. In Guatemala, it's called an expedition.
But
it's because
you have to go somewhere.
The jungle. It's the jungle. The vines.
In 1983, Dr. Adams lined up enough funding to take a small group down there. And I was one of the ones that he asked to go along because he knew I had the experience of working with human burials and that kind of thing from our work at Allen's Creek. And he thought, you know, there was a potential eventually to open up some more tombs that the looters had not found. And so he asked me if I wanted to go. He also asked Steve Black, Fred Valdez, Dan Potter, and some others of us from there. So we went initially.
It's like an elite team of Texas archaeologists. I love it.
83. It was really exciting.
I hope it's not like in MacGruber where they blow up the team.
No.
Okay, good.
It was really exciting because this was, you know, I'd grown up looking at these really fantastic articles in National Geographic magazine about expedition.
Oh, so it had already been romanticized for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But when I actually became a working archaeologist, I realized that the chances of, you know, being involved in something like that were pretty slim. And it didn't bother me because I was really stimulated by problems that we were considering in Texas archaeology.
But it sounds like you were involved in a bunch of very interesting sites.
Well, they were.
And then who's to say what is interesting or not when it comes to archaeology,
you know,
right?
But, you know, the chances of anything we were doing here getting into National Geographic were pretty remote.
Okay. All right.
And that didn't bother me because I was intellectually very stimulated and I love the field work.
Yeah. The field work.
And
that's
everything.
Cool.
And I was just, so, you know, I'd said to myself, you know, it's never going to happen, but so what? I'm okay. But then we got involved in this project. 83, we weren't down there very long, but we were back in the rainforest, what a lot of it's called the thick jungle.
I mean, it's an expedition because you got to change your socks often.
It was,
you know
what I mean? It was pretty rough just to get to the site because we traveled through the rainforest on these dirt roads.
I am not made for that. Could you do that? Travel in the rainforest.
I never went down to Guatemala. But
that's one thing, like traipsing across some scrubby Texas ground. That's nothing compared to.
They were washing their clothes in streams and stuff, right?
There
venomous that first year things. We
got the Rio Azul is the name of the river during the dry season.
Tequila. Matthew's got a fly in his tequila. He's scared of it.
A fly died in my tequila. I got it. Oh. Sorry.
Matthew just threw his tequila at Manish.
I'm sorry. Oh, Manish is here too, by the way.
You will be able to edit this one.
We don't edit anything, but if we start clamming around, just please maintain your train of thought. We'll be right back to you.
Take a break, Dad. Too.
We just started. Come on.
So anyway, it was really just very exciting. That first year, 83, to be going down to Guatemala and going into this very remote ancient Maya city. And what we did that first year was just go around and record what the leaders had found. And it was 8 or 10 tombs, including one very magnificent painted tomb. It had very complicated, elaborate paintings on the walls, and so we documented that.
So there's all kinds of artifacts on the black market because people loot.
There's big money in the sale of the pottery and jades and things like that that come out of tombs like these, and one of them that was reputed, we're pretty sure it really did came out, was a greenstone kind of new supernatural human face that was alleged to have come out of this really beautiful tomb at Rio Azul. And it had already been sold into the international art market for a couple $100,000 or more.
That's on the cover of the National Geographic. So they were able to track it down, but were they able to retrieve it?
No, I don't think it ever was.
Wow.
I think maybe it's kind of disappeared. You know, some wealthy person probably bought it.
So whoever bought it can just say tough luck.
If it's
have this back.
It seems like if it's a private person, you could get it back from a national museum or something.
Yeah,
but
if, you know, shame a museum, and but not all of them do. I mean, there's still a lot of pottery and jades that came out of tombs, you know, that are in some of the more...
In museums, not in their origin country.
Right.
Yeah.
Remind me to write a song called Shame a Museum. go on.
So we did that in 83, and we came back, and Dr. Adams got some pretty good funding from some donors. And we went back again in 84 with a stronger project, more people. We were going to be there longer. And he set me to work on a particular little cluster of pyramids that were actually adjoining the bigger pyramid that had that major tomb in it. And he knew from studying other sites that there ought to be tombs on either side. There were two little mounds that indicated that big pyramid had little smaller pyramids on the side of it. So the hypothesis was that there would be tombs under those. So that's what we started on. And we dug a trench down into that pyramid in 1984, and sure enough, we found a tomb down under there. But we realized we had it right at the end of our season and our funding. So we packed up and we went back, and he went to the National Geographic Society with a request for emergency funding, and they granted his request. So we came back, right, I think it was late April, early May in 1984.
So you were racing against the rainy season? Or?
Yeah, the rainy season would begin late in May, and the roads would be impassable.
Gosh, you know, I've heard this story a bunch in my entire life, but I didn't hear this dramatic. That's a fun, dramatic ride. Well, so you run out funding so that you know the tomb's sitting there, but you haven't popped it yet, right?
That's right. We haven't opened it.
How hard was that to just leave and know that that was down there?
Well, I think he had encouragement, you know, to... He must have been pretty sure.
Okay.
So we came back.
Man, I know you can't rush things in archaeology, but you think maybe just knock a hole in there and see what's down there.
The interesting thing that happened was that a regional reporter for the New York Times got wind of it.
She Fake news.
In Houston.
A failure.
And so there was this rumor going around among certain people, you know, that Adams and his team had found something pretty important.
Among journalists who specialize in archaeological journalists. Sir.
So she got in touch with a reporter named Grace Gleck, who was up in New York City.
I gotta say, all the names and the whole story, they're fantastic names.
We came back and we opened the tomb, and it was very, very interesting. It had paintings on the walls, and there was the skeleton of the dead person in there. The preservation was very good because they had actually carved these tombs out of the limestone bedrock, and they built ceilings over them before they then completed the pyramid. So when we broke through, there was actually a tomb chamber. And one of the things...
what did it smell like in there?
It was certainly no smell of death or anything. It was more like a...
Earth.
Yeah, like potting soil, maybe.
Was sure.
Kind of an right. earthy okay. smell.
A little musty.
And,
yeah. Yeah.
No. I mean, these things were 1500 years old.
I wasn't think it smelled of death. It just seems like the mustiest place in the universe.
It wasn't like Dad was like, no way am I going down there. It stinks too bad.
All right. Right.
So anyway, when other archaeologists would see photographs of what was in the tomb before we started doing anything, they'd often say to me, how long did it take you to expose it to that extent? I said, it was that way when we opened it. You know, they couldn't believe it because they didn't realize that it was...
It was all sealed off?
Yeah, it was sealed off. And there had been a little bit of detritus fall down through the centuries, you know, but basically...
Did you take photographs?
Oh, yeah, photographs and drawings.
Oh, there's some great... And... That the story of the New York Times reporter scooping the National Geographic was a really funny one. And I know Mom, that really captured Mom's imagination, because I remember her telling everybody about that. Well, the New York Times scooped the story from National Geographic. This is the first time in like 10 years, 7, 8 years old. It's the first time I ever heard of anybody scooping a story. But these stories are legendary in my mind, you know, while all this is going on. But the cool thing, you asked about pictures. So there's the New York Times front page that's on there, and it shows the kind of the place where they've dug it out. They've dug the trench, and then there's the hole that they knocked in there. And Dad's figure's big into the story, Dr. Hall, but he's not in the photo because he's down in the hole, but his cowboy hat is sitting right next to the hole. So if you're familiar with Dr. Hall, you know that the
well,
I love that.
It was very interesting contents because the preservation was good. The paintings were on the wall. That was pretty unusual in the Maya region. And there were things preserved. For example, the litter. It was like, if you can imagine, a ladder made of limbs, you know, tied together with vines or whatever. And then on top of it, they had put a mattress that was made of kapok, which is, in the old days, they used to stuff life preservers with it. It's like the product of cottonwood.
Okay.
The ceiba tree produces these pods that burst open and have this fiber in it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they would gather it and put it in a textile bag to make a mattress. So we found evidence of that. There were remnants of textiles. There were jade beads. There were maybe 15 pottery vessels in there.
And evidence of what they contained, too, right? You could tell that some of them
were cow. These cylindrical vessels that had lids on them. And when I took the lid off, if you can imagine, like in your Yeti cup there, if you have a liquid in there and you turn it off of level slightly, the liquid will maintain its level, right?
Uh-huh.
It'll be level even though your cup's turned. So I looked in the pots and you could tell that there had been a liquid in there and it had dried and left a residue on the sides of the vessel. One of the pots has become an icon of Maya archaeology. It was kind of globular shaped and it had a lid on it with a shaped handle, head decorated with hieroglyphs. And we couldn't initially get it open. But we started working with it and it turned out that it had a bayonet locking mechanism internally on it. There were two opposing L-shaped grooves on either side of the main body. And then in the lid, there were these lugs that would fit down. And when you twisted it, that would allow you to pick the pot up.
History's first childproof lid.
Aha, interesting, interesting.
We called it the childproof pot at first, but then
it was really beautifully painted too, right?
Yeah, I had a real interesting series of hieroglyphs on it. So anyway, we got back in 84. Dr. Adams had gotten his PhD at Harvard University, and he sponsored over several years, five of us, up at Harvard. He wrote letters on our behalf, and he got five of us into the graduate program at Harvard. And I was one of them, started up there.
That's so the whole team went up to Harvard together?
Yeah, there. Well, Fred Valdez was the first. And
that's in 84?
When I went.
We went to Harvard.
Steve Black and I were accepted at Harvard.
And you did a graduate program there?
A PhD program at Harvard.
Do you remember your dad being gone for these things?
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
Shiloh had the kids down in San Antonio.
I was going to comment a bit on when he was down in Guatemala. I have very fond memories of his return. I remember once you came back with weird, and that was pretty wild.
Yeah.
Only time in your life I think you've worn a beard.
85, maybe.
But he always came back with amazing gifts from Guatemala. One of which was a machete, and another was a bullwhip. So then we lived at the house on Iron Avenue in San Antonio, had an empty lot next to it. And so I just did the full Indiana Jones thing back there with my bullwhip and my machete.
So did you think it was cool that your dad was an archaeologist?
Oh, hell yeah. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was a used car salesman, so I don't know what that's like. But
that's important, too. People need... Now we could argue that people need cars more than they need dead bodies.
They're different leagues.
But it's...
So anyway, I got into the graduate program. I started in 84, started classes up there, and then we went to Rio Azul. We returned down there in 1985, again in the springtime during the dry season. And we went around to the other side on that pyramid and did the same thing. We trenched in and we found another tomb there. And so that the data, our findings there became the kind of the raw material for my dissertation that I wrote to get my PhD. So I was back up at Harvard and a glyph, a Maya hieroglyphic expert named David Stewart had been reading the glyphs on that twist top pot, that childproof pot.
I was going to ask if, yeah,
and
translation had been done.
He said, basically, this pot was decorated by, and it gave the name glyph of the artist who had drawn it, and was meant to contain cacao, which is the raw material used to make chocolate.
Right. Must have been an expensive, coveted material.
Well, it was
an honor to be buried with. You'll want that in the afterlife.
Right. The Maya, they didn't make chocolate out of it. They basically roasted it and ground it up and made a beverage
right
out of it. And they even put, like, they ground up chili peppers. They like to have it hot, you know, spicy. Mm. So anyway.
Damn, that sounds good.
I was
kind of what we would call mole.
Doing analysis on things that we had found in those tombs. And I went over to MIT, was, you know, neighboring college
yeah,
there.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Fred Wiseman was there, and he was an expert on analyzing plant pollens. And I'd actually gone to see him to ask him if he would take a look at some of our residues and see if he could see what kind of plants were represented. And he said, oh, sure. And he did some great work for us. But while I was there, I was telling him about this pot and what the glyphs said on it. And he said, well, gosh, if you think that pot had cacao in it, you should send some samples to the Hershey Company in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and see if they can verify. I had scrapings out of that twist top pot, but also those other cylindrical pots that had lids on them. There were, I don't remember, 4 or 6 of them in there, and you could tell that they had once held a liquid too.
Okay.
Because liquid had evaporated and it left a residue. So I scraped all those out. And so
I'm dying to know what's in those pots.
I was in my dorm up there at Harvard, and I got on the telephone and I called information directory assistance in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Okay. What a world we lived in.
For the Hershey Company. And I just called, and this receptionist answered. And I said, my name's Grant Hall. I'm a graduate student at Harvard.
Do you have the interchange for old man Hershey?
And I explained to her, and she said, oh, I need to get you in touch with the people in our chocolate research lab.
Yeah.
So that was how it happened. She put me through. And
R&D, can I help you?
I began.
And those nerds were as excited as they'd ever been in their entire life.
I ended up sending the samples to them. And of course, they have very sophisticated analytical instruments and everything there. And not too long, but sometime after I sent them over there, they contacted me and said, yes, those residues do represent cacao. Okay. And the reason was because cacao has two chemicals, theobromine and caffeine, that are both stimulant type.
Yeah, they were jacked on cacao.
They were. That was saying. Part of the benefit or enjoyment of drinking cacao or chocolate beverages is because. And they said, okay, in the twist top pot and two of the cylinder vessels that you sent us samples from, there is theobromine and caffeine. So I ended up writing an article. I was the senior author on it, along with Dr. Adams, the people from Hershey that had done that research. And it was published in the journal American Antiquity in 1990. And it became the basis. It was the first study of its kind. Mm. Where
what is buried with Mayan? And what was the cast, or what was the status of this person?
It was a high level,
like a priest,
probably more like a noble. You might think of a prince.
Just a rich guy.
He was a male.
Yeah,
I think I always heard him described as a prince to me. Yeah.
The guy, or assuming it was a man that was in the main tomb that was looted, he would have been the king.
Okay.
He's in a very opulent tomb. But these people.
There was like a main temple, and this was a side temple.
There were two little. And, seeing them in modern times, they just look like big mounds. And they're covered, initially, they're covered with all kind of palms and.
Yeah. The earth prickly takes it.
Prickly vines and trees and everything.
That's why it's an expedition.
Have to be cleared off. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, a really important finding that came out of that work. And I ended up finishing my dissertation and graduating in 89 and came back to Houston. Started looking around for jobs, and Texas Tech had an opening.
Oh, this is the start of a tragic tale of a young lad who's living his life in Houston. I mean, what a cool town. I was born in Lubbock, and I come from low stock, whereby Lubbock was such a great metropolis. For my family, it was very exciting to be in Lubbock. For a couple dinners.
Listen, it wasn't
easy. But for
easy,
a kid, for a kid.
It came out.
For a middle school
I wouldn't be sitting
kid,
here with Manish and Matthew.
There you go. There you go.
It is a unique place.
Did I tell you?
Hey, Grant, what's your opinion of Lubbock?
I worked in Lubbock.
You like Lubbock?
I like Lubbock.
Okay.
He said he's rooting for Kansas. You know why they root for Kansas City,
right? I know.
Patrick Mahomes.
He was
a Texas Tech Red Raider.
I understand.
I tell you the story the other day? Dick was had a lunch meeting at the Front Page, and the lady he was meeting with, he came over and introduced me. He said, "This is my brother," and she said, "Where are you boys from?" And Dick said, "Lubbock," and she said, "Y'all aren't giving Lubbock." And so later on, we were on the the family thread, and Mom was offended. She was like, "What? You guys are Lubbock?" And I joked. I said, "No, we were given mule shoe."
Oh, that's pretty good. When I looked at Lubbock, and I said, "Why would I'm doing air quotes civilized man make his home here?" I didn't understand because I was watching the TV, and most kids lived with Mr. Drummond in New York City, or they lived on the Bayside in California. Why would anybody make their home in Lubbock? But I mean, I know the whole story of how my family came to be in Lubbock, and it makes sense. But
it is a good question. What I mean, there is a little water there.
It's a nice temperate climate. The climate in Lubbock is really nice. Yeah.
Well,
but for me, the lack of geological features and the lack of trees that weren't planted by the white man.
Well, I'll tell you one thing Shay and I appreciated was slow humidity.
Yeah,
coming
that's
out
what of, I mean. The climate is, it, some,
it's climate.
There are days in Lubbock where it's like a space station. It's the perfect, it's humidity and temperature. And,
summer nights are yeah, very pleasant.
It's, it's lovely, sure. But the lack of you know, geological features and just, I think like in that region, why didn't like Crosbyton, like right there in the canyon draw, wouldn't that be a cool place to have
Post,
a town?
Yeah.
Before we move on from Guatemala, I wanted to bring up another story that looms large, and I think I've actually told it on OMH before, but I wanted to confirm with you to see if it's as I remember it in my head. There was a whistle, a statue, or a mysterious statue. And as I recall, it was Steve Black who figured out its purpose, or was it you?
It was me. The season of 1985, an old friend named John Faggard, who grew up down in Pleasanton, Texas, became a doctor. John came along as our project doctor. But when he wasn't doctoring, which was most of the time, he'd be out assisting in some job on the
hauling dirt.
Yeah,
brushing off stuff.
I remember in particular, he cleaned out one of the looted tombs. Mm-hmm. But he was helping me with, I was bringing stuff out of the second tomb that we found in 1985. And one of the things in there was a little clay figurine. And I've always imagined it was probably, the face was very detailed, and it was probably a portrait of the dead person in there, but you know, I couldn't establish that. But anyway, it had broken up a little bit, and John and I were sitting outside the tomb. And I had some PVC, it's basically like airplane glue, that I was using to carefully put this little figurine back together. And as it came together, I noticed it had a little round hole in the back, and then there was a slit down in the bottom. And, you know, at first I thought maybe it had been on a little staff or something like that. And I thought, no. John was sitting here beside me. And for some reason, I was possessed with the idea, and I turned it over and I blew in the little slot in the bottom.
Oh.
And it was a whistle.
A whistle.
It made a whistling noise, and John and I both looked at each other, you know.
Damn.
And then John said, if you'd blow up my ass, I'd whistle too. So much for scientific inquiry, you know, and serious research and everything.
Also, so much for being immortalized in a tomb when really your portrait isn't in there and your people are just whistling up your ass.
I kind of wondered, you know, I thought possibly since it was a whistle, it wasn't located directly over the mouth, but I wondered if they might have placed that over the mouth of the dead person. It might be something like, you know, how some people in modern times put some kind of alarm.
Interesting. System. Oh, to see if they're still alive.
Yeah, in case you wake
that's
up.
That's a cool, yeah.
If you wake up in your casket and you're, you know, they've made a bad mistake.
That's an interesting idea.
I had no proof of that. But
that might explain why it fell over and was broken.
There are other whistles known from the Maya sites.
Isn't there a Mayan death whistle or something?
There's a death color, which was the color that was on that twist top pot. It's kind of a pale blue.
I love it that the artist's name was on the pot. Because I was already like, when I was asking you about the status of the person, and I was like kind of feeling jealous of the guy who got this nice tomb. But I think it's cool that like the artisans that then contributed to it, then I don't, they sort of like get mini memorialized. And
well, the thing is, I don't know if this is still true, if the thinking goes this way among hieroglyphic experts down there, but at the time, the general belief was that it was probably only the nobility that knew how to produce those glyphs and knew what they meant. So that would be why, you know, because the person was already some high status.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I educated. Mean, that to me also speaks of how artisans have always been in this other class where you're not noble, but you're not peasant, and you deserve recognition as an artist, right? That kind of what you're saying?
Right.
Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that only the nobles were even able to do that?
Well, they were, and I think the reason the name was on there is because this might have been some type of memorial gift or something. That's actually known too. In fact, Dr. Adams was well known for his analysis of a pot that had been, this was another site called Altar de Sacrificios, but he had found a pot that had been brought as an offering, you know, by some living people to honor the dead person in another tomb. But
this is conjecture on my part, but
what the podcast is about.
I do know that, you know, in a lot of cultures, writing is considered sacred, not just.
Oh, yeah.
And I could see
the word is God.
I could see the nobles, even it being something that you would want to keep from the proletariat, honestly, as a way of
maintaining power.
Very upfront.
Forgive me for being excessively Marxist.
Because they would
that's
have
no problem with me.
These stele, big limestone monuments.
I love those. That's like
they're super cool.
I love all the Mayan glyphs and iconography, and like some of my early like drawings and stuff are like
they're spectacular.
The stele and
they would be erected in these ceremonial plaza areas in the main, where the big pyramids were, where ceremonies were carried out. And so you were talking about
the common, information on that. It's like the common information people, kiosk.
The common people would be out in the plaza, and the front of the stela would have usually a full frontal image of an important person, probably the ruler. And he would be depicted as himself, and all the writing was on the backside, where the nobility, the intelligentsia were standing. They were the people that could actually read what was on there.
Interesting.
And the Maya part of it, a lot of it was calendric information. The Maya had a very accurate
calendar. Yeah.
And they often it would be
That's another way to maintain your hold on power, is to accurately predict what's happening in the sky, right? Mm-hmm.
Commemorate maybe a conquest of your little city over some neighboring city. Or
man, you remember when we whipped their asses, cut off all their heads, and drank their blood? Man, that was cool. Let's build a thing where the sun would come into a hole and a
sort of kind of go back to the narrative.
Sorry, no, you want to go back to the narrative?
You don't have to. Whatever you guys want to do, but the time in Lubbock at Texas Tech engendered a whole another group of adventures called the field schools that my brother and I got to go on.
Yeah. What's the field schools, Greg?
Well, a lot of archaeology programs as part of the training will take students out on summer field schools where they learn some of the basic field techniques. And so I wanted to do that when I started teaching at Texas Tech. The first field school that I ran was in 1991, and they lasted 6 weeks. We came down here to Mills County, across the river from us here, okay, in 91. That's the one you came out on, that one. And since I'd had this experience in Guatemala, one aspect of it, I was very fortunate that Dr. Adams was, he had been a Marine, and he had been a real active in Boy Scouts. And he ran a very clean, efficient camp down there in Guatemala. So I tried to set up.
It was the fine line between you and jungle rot, right?
Well, yeah, or, you know, serious dysentery.
Or your whole expedition dying. Getting everybody back alive.
Yeah, everybody's standing in line at the latrine, you know. And
there were times in the field school when I wasn't sure I was going to get back.
I hate it when
that's absolutely a joke.
I hate it when there's a long line at the latrine.
But anyway, we set up our field camps, you know, out in a remote area. And I, even though we had a lot of amenities compared to being down there, some of my classmates up at Harvard had worked in Kenya and other places where, you know, things were really, really tough.
Rugged.
So it was not like that here in Texas. But I ended up having, between 91 and 2004, I ran 12 field schools. We worked down in this area for 6 years. We worked.
And honestly, forgive me, but I don't remember what project we were working on in that first field school. Some kind of Native American.
Yeah, it was a hunter-gatherer site on the Barnett Ranch.
But then you guys got involved with the mission.
That was later, 94. I was associated with two people that were looking for the San Saba mission.
A lost Spanish mission?
Yeah, a lost Spanish mission. And we found it based primarily on some historical research that Kay Hines had done. Mark Wolf was a direct lineal descendant of a man that had survived the 1758 attack, Indian attack on the mission. And anyway, he, because of his ancestry, he was interested in finding the mission. And we found it in 94 and came out. I had a field school there in 97. We had a major excavation there.
Where was that? In South Texas?
Menard.
Okay. That was the mission of San Saba.
San Saba mission.
Which is where we are. We're sitting in San Saba County right now.
Oh, I see. Oh, so it's nearby here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. About,
okay. 70 miles over there, right, to the west of us. And there was also a Spanish fort on the west side of Menard that we went to work on. And the archaeologist who succeeded me at Texas Tech, Tamara Walter, did a whole lot of work on the Presidio, the fort. So Tech had a, you know, big presence there in Menard County, working on those two Spanish sites down there.
So there was the nuclear plant site, and there were you went to the Lubbock Lake site, and then you were in Guatemala, and then all this amazing work here in Central Texas, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about that dumbass anthropologist professor at the University of Texas that wrote your dad that letter? I mean, I know he was well-intentioned, and he couldn't see the future.
No, that was the thing.
He was wrong.
I say, I've just been very lucky in the things that have happened to me, and that was the first bit of luck. Because back at the time he wrote that letter,
it wasn't wrong.
He wasn't aware of this groundswell or these. It was actually just a couple of archaeologists that got archaeology included as part of the Environmental Protection Act.
Okay.
And they opened up.
Does history know their names?
Oh, yeah. They're, I,
we don't. That's I
would well, to, they're not interesting like Gail Gibble. Well, or all
those other but names. They were responsible for a lot of young archaeologists actually getting employed in the field. And it's still going on today. It's gone initially. It was research facilities that were associated with universities. And it kind of segued into private company work. And Elton Pruitt, who was my first mentor, my biggest mentor, opened up his own, we call it cultural resource management, but basically it was an archaeological investigation company, privately run. And he was very successful at it. The company, it's been bought up by a larger corporation now. But so anyway, it was just lucky that I showed up and had gotten a little bit of experience by the time a lot of these jobs started happening. And so
this is by the grace of God we go kind of thing, right? You know,
it is.
And then always
an interesting thing to me about the Lubbock landmark site, Lubbock Lake site, which then became the Lubbock landmark in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And when they made it, I don't know what it was, a state or national landmark, they were looking for docents to come and give tours, basically learn about the site and give tours of the site. And they were, I think it was probably Mr. Swift's biology class where I heard about it. I said, sure, I'd like to do that. And I didn't know at the time that my dad had worked on it. Sure. But then I spent the next year going out there on Saturdays and giving tours of the Lubbock
Wild
Lake site. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Eileen Johnson is still on the faculty in the museum science program, and she still runs a field school out there every summer now, over 50 years later.
So they're still excavating to do out there? Wow, oh, that's cool.
Well, I don't mean to pry. I just had wondered about your career and your interests in archaeology.
Matthew, you're a good interviewer. Yeah, Alex Battles always talks about it.
Yeah, and you know why? It's because I care about people.
Alex Battles compares Matthew to Dick Cavett.
It's the greatest compliment of my life is Alex Battles comparing me to Dick Cavett.
I'm more of a David Letterman, I guess.
Well, I haven't listened to all the episodes, but I've listened to quite a few, and I really enjoy all of them. You guys do a great job.
Oh, thanks.
This was definitely going to be a favorite.
It's funny because the last time we were here, we had just started it. And I feel like we were talking about it when
That's
we were
funny,
here.
Yeah.
And you were like, huh. And I wouldn't have predicted that you would be a listener, but I love it. And that's, I always try to become friends with my friend's parents.
Probably in my ignorance, I didn't know what a podcast was.
Neither did we. No. No, I don't know. I think we still don't know what a podcast is, but we're getting closer.
No, I think
on this 200th episode
it's
celebration.
It's been a lot of fun to watch you guys evolve. And
we're going to record some more stuff while we're here. And I'm going to edit it together in the most hilarious way. But the middle is the
grand. Manish can't wait to do some more recording.
We're going to interview Manish later. And what Manish is going to do is give us a critique of this interview. He's going to be like, he was like, I remember this thing you said, and you could have really probed more on that. But
post game show.
All right, look, this is the end of the interview, but keep continuing.
Some nights you're struggling with indecision. Some nights you know just where the answer lies. Some nights you think you may have found religion. Some nights you're lost beneath an empty sky. Comes a warm night and the air just flows. The sun goes down and the street lights glow. And you step right up and you just let go. Things just come alive and now you're talking to jive.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
Yes, alright. So many wrong decisions. It's alright, you and everyone you know. Rough ride, full of many hard collisions. Tough ride, but it takes you where you need to go. Comes a warm night walking through the door. You feel so strong, you just want more. No old, no young, no rich, no poor. Things just come alive, and now you're talking to Jeff.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
Yeah, 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 now.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
Stage and you bust right out of your see-through cage. Things just come alive and now you're talking to Jive.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
Yeah, 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 now.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright.
It's alright.
Sometimes it's just alright. Sometimes it's just alright. Sometimes it's just alright.
Sometimes it's just all.